Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and we have a two-hour Zero Point radio show. We're on every second week through BBS. Welcome. This show deals with the studies of mystical and spiritual psychology, study of ancient metaphysics and modern physics, ideas about science, life. We really cover a very broad spectrum of areas in our discussions, but focusing on the idea of the psychology of a human's possible evolution. Ordinarily, people think of evolution, and when they think of that term, they think only of the evolution of the physical organism, like the and they think of what Uspensky once referred to as the, quote, monkey-to-man business, the idea of physical evolution, that human beings evolve through random genetic changes from higher primates, who in turn had evolved through random genetic changes and mutations from lower mammals, and all of life ultimately traced back to one original life form, which might have emerged out of the oceans or on lands or whichever. That's the idea of physical evolution. From the Gurdjieff and a mystical perspective, we want to also consider the idea of the spiritual or a mystical evolution of a human being, and that a similar development of inner form can occur within the human being, and that a human being can evolve. And Gurdjieff explains that there are really seven levels of human beings. So instead of thinking just of man or human beings as a one, Gurdjieff would explain that really there are seven levels of human beings, and that the powers and capabilities of these seven types are very different. And just as there is evolution of physical forms, there's also another kind of evolution which refers to this inner evolution of a human being in terms of the development of their own consciousness and being existence, that we might attain to seven levels of development. And it's explained in life, people are ordinarily of only the three lower types, what Gurdjieff calls man number one, man number two, and man number three. And these types are governed by one of the three primary being brains of a human being. That a human being doesn't simply have one mind in the head, but really a human being has a threefold nature. And he functions mentally, centered in the mind in the head, emotionally, related to the autonomic nervous system and the heart, and physically, related to the capacities for sensation and movement in the physical body. So a human being is regarded as having a threefold nature. We function mentally, emotionally, and physically. In contrast, modern psychology is always considered psychology as the science of behavior and the mind, as though you only have the mind and the body in a dualistic way. In contrast, Gurdjieff in the Fourth Way teaching explains human beings function mentally, emotionally, and physically. So we have a threefold nature. So most of the three lower types of the seven types of human beings are people who vary in which of those three aspects is most developed in them, where their principal center of functioning is. Some people are more intellectually centered, others more emotionally centered, and other more physically and instinctually centered. So most often people tend to be developed in one or another of those three primary areas. And so they remain what Gurdjieff would call a man number one, two, or three. So from the Gurdjieff perspective, the idea of evolution then has to do with the idea that whereas ordinary life only produces types one, two, and three, There are other levels which are attainable to us. We might become a man number 4, 5, 6, or 7. We might attain to these higher levels of spiritual evolution. And these attainments depend upon the awakening of consciousness within a human being and the refinement of the energies necessary for what are called the higher being bodies. Whereas people ordinarily think of themselves as having only a physical body, there are also higher being bodies. And these are most commonly known as, for the moment, the astral or emotional body and the mental body. So we don't only have a physical body, but we really have a physical, astral, and mental body, again reflecting the same triune nature. So we have three bodies. Gurdjieff explains that although everybody has an astral and a mental body, in most people they're not very developed, because people all the time waste all their energies in life. They waste the energies of the astral body, their emotional body, by all their unnecessary negative emotions and their self-centered patterns of emotions. So we don't refine the energies within the astral body. And similarly, we don't refine the energies or matters of the mental body. So these inner being bodies, the astral and mental bodies, are bodies which have to be attained. That you have to acquire them, in a sense. Although the potential is there and there's a certain astral matters, in a way you can acquire the faculties of the astral and mental bodies. And this is part of what would mean in terms of evolution. Evolution is from the idea from the is ascent from the physical into the spiritual. So this would be an evolution or a development of the inner being bodies of a human being. So whereas in normal science or popular science we have only this idea of physical evolution, the scientists don't have any idea about the inner evolution of a human being, how we might attain to higher levels of development through awakening of consciousness and the higher centers, and attaining new faculties. Gurdjieff explains that there are 5 lower centers in the physical body and 2 higher centers, which he calls a higher intellectual and higher emotional center. He says in most people, these higher centers are there, they're present, but a person can't connect with them, that their level of vibration and energy is too far below the refined levels of these higher centers. So we have to awaken to these higher centers, the higher emotional and the higher intellectual. Whereas people in common life are man number 1, 2, and 3, the level of the 4th level is what we want to inquire into. The 4th level involves a person who develops mentally, emotionally, and physically, simultaneously, and brings those 3 natures into alignment, which then transforms into a 4th level. So there's that threefold nature, and if those bodies and centers are developed in the right way, you can attain to a 4th level. And this 4th level involves the experience of this a higher state of consciousness, which I would call self-consciousness. And this Gurdjieff describes as involving the awakening to the higher emotional center. So this 4th level is beginning to awaken of the higher emotional center. And Gurdjieff describes in the person who's balanced the 3 lower aspects, the physical, emotional, and mental, and attain to the fourth level. In a way, for Gurdjieff, this is what it means to acquire one's own eye. Gurdjieff says that normally in life, people know only little eyes, and our eyes are always changing. We're happy, we're sad, we're this, we're that. We always say I to everything in life, and we have know only a legion of eyes, a multitude of eyes. But the idea is we don't realize what real I is. And real I is something within us, but which is beyond our level of experience and realization. So we have to awaken to the experience of real I within ourselves, and to cultivate that inner self-existence, inner awareness of self-existence. Now, in the Gurdjieff's masterpiece story, Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, he's explaining at one point to his grandson, Hussein, who in this book is this story of Gurdjieff as Beelzebub is traveling on a spaceship through our solar system, or within the galaxy, rather. And he's explaining to his grandson his different visits to the planet Earth, because he apparently had lived on the planet Mars and had a telescope set up on Mars. And beings from Mars had interblended with human beings on planet Earth through history. Anyway, in this story, Beelzebub is flying with his grandson, and he's flying through the cosmos, and he's telling about those strange three-brained beings on planet Earth. And in this story, he explains to his grandson, Hussein, how that at one point in human history, the human beings had their emotional center within an organ in the region of the breast, is his exact phrase, which I would take to signify the heart, the human heart, that our emotional center used to be in the heart, or in the higher beings, it's in the heart. But Beelzebub explained in human beings, it got distributed through the complex of nerves of what are called the autonomic nervous system. So there was a downgrading, in a sense, of our emotional center, and it got locked into the autonomic nervous system. So I would say the autonomic nervous system is the basis of our usual states of experience and emotions. And yet the original center of emotional life was supposed to be the heart. So I would take this awakening of the higher emotional center is related to the awakening of the heart and the realization of I within the heart. So this is the experience of a man number four is awakening and developing the experience of this I within self. Gurdjieff explains in the man number four, it is an experience which comes and goes and isn't permanent. It's not yet solidified. So a person's self-consciousness is a state that comes and passes. In the man number five, that is permanent, becomes permanent. In the man number six and seven, then, Gurdjieff explains that these people awaken the higher intellectual center. Okay, so and he says this is associated with the state of what he calls objective consciousness. And he says in the state of objective consciousness, we can perceive directly the nature of different aspects of the cosmos, that we can experience these directly and attain experience through these higher faculties of the mind. So this would be similar to attaining the mental body. Okay, so a person who had a fully developed mental body, then enters what Gurdjieff calls the fourth room. And Gurdjieff explains this is what we want to attain. And the fourth room is a level of what is sometimes called the causal body. And this causal body in the human being, if a person attains this level of inner evolution, of attaining to the causal body, then in a way you acquire real I, and you are said to be, quote, immortal within the limits of the solar system. So you've acquired your individuality and will maintain your individuality through the life of the solar system, implying that you take other forms or exist in other realms and sometimes reincarnate through different lives. So the idea in the Gurdjieff teaching, as in mystical teachings generally, is that this form of inner evolution of a human being can occur, that we can awaken to different levels of consciousness, awaken the heart and experience things directly through the dimensions of the heart, that we can attain to the higher mental faculties and acquire these higher faculties of the mind. So all of this is a form of evolution, not of the physical nature, but of the inner man or inner woman, the inner being. So whereas upon death, your physical body might return to the earth, the inner being passes, or it doesn't pass into other dimensions, it just sheds the physical. In a way, it doesn't have to move anywhere. But there is then continued self-existence within the subtle bodies, within the subtle dimensions. And even for people who do not develop in terms of their evolution, those people also have continued existence within subtle dimensions after their death. And they can be drawn into different realms, according to Gurdjieff. Gurdjieff explains that when some souls die, they pass to the moon. So a person can feed the moon, in a sense, upon their death. And the physical body might feed the earth. But a person also might haunt the earth upon the death. Other people will pass into the astral planes, astral realms, and even into what Gurdjieff calls purgatory, which is a realm where of retributive processes and purging thing characteristics out of people, that there might be various purgatory states. So all of this suggests that a human being, we through modern science and education in a way have been completely deceived as to what we really are. Because all through science and education, we're taught that we're kind of physical, biological organisms that firstly have no spirit or soul nature, that you're only a physical thing, being, and that there is no real I in the human being. The scientist Isaac Asimov says that the idea of there being an I, an individual I in the human being, is only an illusion, and that all our I is an illusion built up of different molecules which form together and can produce this experience of I. But Asimov says when the body dies, that the molecules break down, so there can't be any continued existence of an I. Similarly, Francis Crick, who wrote a book on consciousness and the soul, and he suggested we are nothing but, quote, a pack of neurons. So that all you are is a pack of neurons. So when your brain dies, you're dead. So the mainstream of science, they have no concept of there being an inner I or real I within the human being. And scientists don't imagine what this could be. And they think of evolution as only the evolution of the physical form. And they have no understanding of how there might be the evolution of the inner man, that we might acquire our higher being bodies for the continued existence of the soul through its afterlife states. So in mystical teachings, we want to awaken to these higher faculties and refine these within ourselves. And this isn't something you can just do and experience once or twice. This is like a lifelong process of refining and attaining to these higher being bodies. This is all very important. And Gurdjieff, to illustrate it, I'll refer to a tale from earlier about Gurdjieff talking to a young boy, Fritz Peters, and he looks out and there's an oak tree. And there are all these acorns on the ground around the oak tree. And Gurdjieff asks Fritz Peters, as a boy, how many acorns there are. And Peters says, well, there's hundreds of them, thousands maybe. And then Gurdjieff asks, and how many of those will become real oak trees? And Fritz Peters says, well, maybe only a few, maybe none. And Gurdjieff says, we have to understand ourselves by studying nature. In nature, there are many possibilities given for individual nuts to become oak trees, to come in to undergo this form of evolution and develop these higher faculties latent within themselves. But Gurdjieff explains that most people, or most acorns, are nuts. Instead, they don't attain to those higher levels of development or evolution. And instead, he says, they become fertilizer, that they would deteriorate and go back into the earth and feed the moon. So, in a way, we have to think of ourselves as nuts who might become oak trees. And this is not simply, in modern thought, you think you can develop physically, like you can get in better shape and do physical things. And you can develop emotionally. So you don't have anxieties and depressions and angers and irritations and such all the time, but you refine higher spiritual emotions. And you can develop mentally and develop the higher faculties of your mind. But in modern science, we think that only the mind is only developing different cognitive abilities. We don't envision how it includes the development of mental faculties within the mental planes of existence. So in spiritual mystical psychology, it concerns this whole science of man's possible evolution, how we can attain to these different levels of development, become a man number 4, 5, 6, or 7, and how we have to work on ourselves. We have to strive to attain this. And in Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, which is Gurdjieff's major book, there's a whole story explaining the kind of science of these possibilities, as they are explained within Uspensky's writings on Gurdjieff, In Search of the Miraculous. Okay, so then what I've been talking about is the idea of the evolution as not simply a physical thing, but evolution of the inner human being. Gurdjieff explains when we die, we can feed the moon, or he says we can attain to the level of the sun. Okay, that we originate out of the sun, and our I is related to the physics and metaphysics of what the sun is. So we want to attain, and the individual I in the person can attain to the sun above, or be drawn into the moon below. So a man's soul is kind of caught between these spiritual world above and the material world below. And depending on our psychology in our life, we will either evolve or we will involve. To involve means that we will be drawn into lower realms of being self-existence, where there's a further restriction on our being self-awareness. So this then is a bit of an introduction to our ongoing talks here. My name's Christopher Holmes. My website is at www.zeropoint.ca. Through this series, we talk about the work of Gurdjieff and Uspensky, theosophy and Madame Blavatsky, science, physics, metaphysics. We really cover a broad range of teachings and ideas. And the last couple of weeks, my co-host here, James Moffat, has particularly been sharing other teachings from the Gurdjieff background and perspective, and we were going to pick up on the fourth way teaching once again today. Jim, how are you?
Oh, good. How are you, Chris?
Okay, good. Any comments on things I was saying, especially about like the idea of spiritual evolution instead of how people ordinarily only have the concept of physical evolution? They think it's only a physical thing. They don't have the concept of how we could attain these higher levels of evolution into spiritual realms or the subtle dimensions.
Yeah, like Gurdjieff says that it says that there's that evolution, as we normally understand it, occurs on a scale of time which is is quite unfathomable for us, and that the position of individuals is very different in the sense that no mechanical evolution is possible for them because of the shortness of their lifetime, but at the same time they have a unique opportunity because they can evolve through the evolution of consciousness. And he says that consciousness cannot evolve of itself or mechanically. It requires effort and requires, in his term, systematic study of oneself and work on oneself. And that in a sense, what you were talking about, people stand between the choice of involving or evolving. He says at one point that, in a sense, to consciously evolve is really to go against nature and to go against God, in the sense that everything is sort of stacked against it. The odds are very formidable, and the outcomes are most likely that people won't evolve because of the rule of sleep and the fact that people exist normally in a state of waking sleep, and that it's very difficult to overcome this. To man number 1, 2, and 3 that you were talking about, the moving or practical and the emotional and the intellectual man are all on the same level of being and consciousness. They're all sleepwalkers. They're all people who live in normally in a state of sleep and have to overcome that state of sleep in order to develop these higher being bodies, develop the sense of I and unity, develop consciousness, and develop will. And as Gurdjieff says, because of the powers of the human condition, of the state of sleep in which we live, it's very difficult to overcome this, and that in order to do so, we need to study ourselves in terms of a system. We have to work on ourselves in terms of a system, and we have to work on ourselves with the guidance of a teacher. And he says that one of the analogies he drew quite frequently, one of his favorite analogies, was that in their current condition, people were in prison, and that in order to escape from prison, one person might do so on his own, but if that person joined together with a group of other people and worked together to escape from prison, then the chances were much greater if they were all working together with a common aim. And so in his teaching, in the Fourth Way teaching, he worked with groups of pupils who worked together to help one another to attempt to wake up, to develop consciousness, and to overcome the sleep in which we normally live. Coincidentally, very strangely, earlier today, I was thinking about a guy who had escaped from prison in Montreal in the 1960s. It was a very famous case in Canada because this guy went out in the middle of March and to water the rink, and it was above zero, which was kind of strange. And in watering the rink, he and another guy got together and escaped from prison. And I was trying to think of the guy's name, and about an hour and a half later, I turned on the CBC radio, And within 5 minutes, they started talking about prison escapes. And the first thing that they said was they talked about the Lucien Rivard case in Montreal in the 60s when he went out to water the rink and escaped from prison with this other guy. So anyway, I thought I should bring up the prison metaphor because and Gurdjieff's analogy to that, because it's a very good reference, in the sense that as there's nothing in Gurdjieff's teaching, there's no romancing of people with attainment of higher states, in the sense that he says that, you know, these things are possible. He says at one point, people can't even imagine the possibilities that human beings have. But the problem is, at the same time, is that they don't realize the situation that they're in. They don't recognize that they're asleep, and that they don't recognize how difficult it is to awaken from sleep. And so in a sense that we are imprisoned. We are imprisoned by ourselves, and in order to escape that imprisonment, the first thing we have to do is we have to study ourselves, and we have to study ourselves in terms of a very definite system, which provides us with the knowledge of who we are and what we can become.
Yeah, and it what's so interesting, that relates to what Gurdjieff describes as the aim in Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson book, which he says is to corrode without mercy all the rubbish accumulated through the centuries within human mentation.
Yeah.
And he kind of saw all this rubbish of what he calls the wiseacres, like these, what he calls the scientists of new formation.
I was just going to say that kind of brings it back to the there's another angle on this too, in the sense that he talks about knowledge, the line of knowledge and the line of being, and in a sense, one of the really important distinctions he makes is that that it's important to know things, but at the same time, we have to develop in relation to our knowledge, we have to develop our being. And he talks about, he says that people in Western culture and modern thought tend to equate being with just the fact of existence. But he says that, like, for instance, if we look at the difference between a mineral and a plant, we recognize a difference in the level of being. And if we look at the difference between a plant and an animal, we recognize there's a further distinction. But he says that in reality, what people don't understand is that the differences possible for human beings in terms of their levels of beings are greater than that between a mineral and an animal. And he says that, you know, for the sleepwalkers, for the man number 1, 2, and 3, people who exist in a state of waking sleep and don't possess consciousness and will and unity, they can't fathom that a man number 4, 5, 6, or 7, these higher levels of being, are I'm trying to think of what the term is, but they're so qualitative, they're discontinuous with the lower waking state of waking sleep, and they are fundamentally different in terms of the level of being, that these people exist in a higher level of being, have attained a higher level of being, which in part relates to what you were talking about earlier, like in man number 4, the astral body has been attained, and people can function in that higher being body, and in that higher being body, they have faculties of knowing, which allows them to know things objectively that are invisible to people in the lower states of consciousness, the normal waking state, so-called.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you would have extended faculties of feeling and knowing and intuitive understanding and such.
Yeah.
And then the extensions of the mind and the mental body. The room number 4 is like a person who attains I and then has complete mastery over the physical, astral, and mental bodies. Yeah, it's such a beautifully coherent kind of system, eh? It's so intelligible.
Exactly.
Thought-wise. It doesn't mean it's true, but it's very intelligible.
Well,
it's a coherent kind of teaching.
Just, just the whole idea of people being incomplete, but being potentially multidimensional, multi-level beings, when you begin to think in those terms, it just reveals the flat land of modern psychology and science. Like, Uspensky at one point characterizes that there are two psychologies. He says that psychology isn't really a modern science that started in the laboratory of Wilhelm Wundt in the 1870s, as is commonly supposed, but rather that psychology is the oldest science, and that for thousands of years people have studied the psychology of human beings' conscious possibilities of their conscious evolution, and there have been all sorts of different esoteric and mystical systems that have pursued this goal. And then you have modern psychology, which he says is psychology of man as he is, or rather as man as scientists imagine him to be. And so there's these like two distinctively different psychologies, and the modern psychology doesn't really recognize the multidimensional nature of human being and the possibilities of attaining and transforming to higher states of consciousness. It's dualistic, formatory in Gurdjieff's terms, in the sense that there's this and there's that. Like, there's the mind and the body. There's the science of behavior in the mind, but there's no recognition of the possibility of transformation and the development of higher faculties of consciousness and being. Whereas in ancient esoteric and mystical psychologies, the entire study of psychology is premised on the idea that some acorns can become oak trees, that some people can realize these higher states of consciousness and being, and willfully transform themselves through the study of themselves, like through self-knowledge. Like Gurdjieff says that know thyself is generally attributed to Socrates, but he says it's really a much more ancient aphorism, and the full aphorism is, man, know thyself, and thou wilt know the universe and the gods, which suggests that by knowing oneself in the true sense of the word, not in terms of one's superficial likes and dislikes and personality and proclivities, but to know oneself as the deeper self, the universal self, in which we all possess, but which is dormant in us, we can know the universe and the gods. And there are numerous accounts and explanations of these experiences of cosmic consciousness, in which people who attain higher states of consciousness are one with the universe and with God. And in modern thought, there's a tendency to poo-poo that idea, or to mock it, or to attribute it to some sort of delusions, but in reality it's describing what literally can occur if somebody develops a higher state of consciousness and being, that they can actually know themselves, the universe, and the gods.
Yeah, which would certainly make us a very different type of being than what we're normally taught that we are, kind of.
Yeah.
Either in science or religion. It's like it's like the fourth way teachings in between science and religion. Like, science has tended to view us as only material biological beings and denied anything else, and religions have kind of lulled us into sleep by telling us, oh, we all got souls and we'll live happily ever after in heaven, and kind of like, so, and the Gurdjieff teaching is kind of saying, well, we're stuck in between there, and that we have, Gurdjieff says, we don't have a soul, but we can acquire one, and we can, yeah.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, because if anything, his depiction of the situation is quite different from, in terms of its emphasis, from even other esoteric teachings that I'm familiar with, in the sense that you really get with Gurdjieff, you really get a sense of the gravity of the situation and the urgency of the situation, and that he says the possibilities for everything in existence are finite. Like, at one time, Uspensky asked him about the idea of eternal recurrence, and he said, well, which is a Nietzschean idea about the idea that we live this life over and over again. But Gurdjieff said, well, if I told you that that's true, and then you'd say, well, you know, why do I have to do anything? Because there's an infinite number of recurrences and there's always a possibility. But he said, even within the relative truth of that idea. He said, you know, everything, the possibility for everything is finite. So we've only got so many chances at this, and so it's important to work in this life, you know, rather than thinking, well, I'll catch in the next life. You know, it's like the disease, what he calls the disease of tomorrow, which is like one of the most pronounced aspects of sleep, and one of the major reasons why people always put off till tomorrow because of, you know, what they could do today, because of that aspect of our psyche, is that we're lazy, we don't want to work, we don't, you know, we want to believe that, you know, when we die we'll all go to heaven and be with Jesus and sing and drink
or
wine
somehow
all day.
Are lulled into sleep.
Lulled into sleep. But the other side of it is like we might end up just, you know, becoming like the acorns that don't become oak trees and become fertilizer. You know, we go back to nature and help further oak trees develop, you know.
Yeah.
So I like that about Gurdjieff's teaching, in a sense, is that I'm not sure, you know, if it's true or if he's saying that for effect, or, you know, to dramatize how important it is to work, but I mean, there's nothing comforting about it. In a sense, it's kind of scary, and definitely gives one a sense of urgency.
Yeah, waking up to the contemporary situation of humankind is a pretty shocking experience, really, to kind of wake up to really realizing more what's happened in human history and what's happened in modern societies. It's really quite horrifying that more broadly you can see it. And I understand how Gurdjieff in Beelzebub's Tales, he says how there's created in human beings what he calls a false consciousness system. And people's ordinary consciousness is kind of conditioned by this false consciousness system, which is like what he had called the false ego, or it's more like your personality nature. So I can see how much we have, through our lives, have been conditioned into a false consciousness system, mainly through the media, which have completely engendered this kind of whole false consciousness system, this whole set of lies about all the things that unfold in the news about the wars and the criminality in the society and what's happening, you know, around the world, like, you know, invasions of Iraq and the possible wars, the whole media kind of engenders a whole false consciousness system. People have been conditioned through time so much by the media, which has intentionally created this kind of false consciousness system.
Well, I would say that I'm not sure I agree with that in the sense that when you say intentionally, I mean, you know, they do it, but I would say like the false consciousness system starts with your parents and your family and
with the school
system and with your church and with your playmates when you're a kid. Like, you know, it's interesting watching how people condition. I watch parents with their children all the time, you know, how they condition them, you do this, you do that, like to be socially appropriate, you know, and in a sense that it's like, you know, in one sense it's like everybody likes a nicely well-behaved child, but in another sense too, it's kind of like, you know, it's like it's the beginning of the big brainwashing and the lie, and it's like that's, you know, it's the distinction Gurdjieff makes between personality and essence is that, you know, personality is what we learn in life and what we acquire through our socialization and our education and our conditioning. And some of it's very useful. I mean, a lot of it's very useful, you know. It's good to know that, you know, when the light turns green, that's when you walk, and when it's red, you stop, or you're going to get hit by a car, you know. And it's good to know certain facts and figures, and, you know, there's all sorts of useful knowledge. But as he says, there's the essence in people, too, which is what we are in terms of our temperament and our predisposition and our abilities and our capacities and our physical type and our emotional type. And he says, you know, like that grows in children, but it grows to about the age of 4 or 5, and then personality starts to grow over essence like a crust, and really, like, there's these layers of personality. And so he says it's not uncommon for somebody, even an accomplished person, the President of the United States could have the essence of a child because they've developed a certain personality, you know, and they know how to BS people, they know how to get along, you know, they know how to play the game because they're, you know, they have education and they're socialized, you know, and they're socially appropriate and, you know, get rewarded for their ability to do things. But really, in essence, they're still children. And I would say, like, if you look at the people who, most people in life, you know, that's what they are. They're like large children in suits, you know. and they have the essence of children. I mean, I think George Bush has the essence of about a 5-year-old child, you know. Like, and I'm sure, like, most of the other leaders in the world fall exactly into that. So it's like, you know, in a way, it's like the rule of sleep is so pervasive and it takes on so many different forms that it's difficult to kind of see it for what it is unless you start to study it yourself and you start to see, well, I'm a sleepwalker, you know, and it looks like everybody around me is a sleepwalker, and it leads to an entirely different perspective. But that's what I would say, is that in a sense it's like, yeah, the media distorts things and lies things and does. There's all sorts of things in the mass media which are meant to control people and to make them good consumers and to push them into certain attitudes, opinions, and beliefs. But it's so much more pervasive than that. I mean, it's on every level of society that because people are sleepwalkers, they reinforce sleep in other people.
Yeah. I mean, there's different aspects to it. I see it as a more intentional creation of a false consciousness system. That's just kind of the way I see the New World Order has created this kind of false consciousness system. Like, you know, it's said about, like, if you imagine the human being as having 7 centers, and the central center is the heart chakra. And you have 3 chakras below it and 3 chakras or energy levels above it. And the heart is in the center. And it is sometimes said that man number 1, 2, and 3 are governed by their lower 3 chakras. And the principal motives of those are said to be money, sex, and power. So certainly if we look at, like, the life of humankind and the kind of madness of man, what he's doing and around the world. I mean, we just see those money, sex, and power. That's what it's all about, is, you know, people who will make millions and billions of dollars off creating weapons and murdering people, and they don't care. Like, they in a way, it's their own egoic motive of money, sex, and power. And so many are kind of tied into sex scandals and whatever. You know, this is money, sex, and power. You know, power, politics, and how, you know, it's like the power has been taken away from the people. It's kind of, you know, these people who most want to ascend in money, sex, and power have risen to the top, you know. So that's the life of humankind on that lower level. And then the next level of awakening is the awakening of the heart and the heart center. So that involves this awakening to the next level of consciousness, that, you know, there's something beyond just money, sex, and power. Don't put your store in life into money, sex, and power, you know, because it'll leave you empty in yourself. These people, I like how in Beelzebub's tales, Gurdjieff refers to people as terrestrial nullities.
Yes.
Kind of like beings like that. Yeah, they're kind of nothing inside.
Nothing.
Like, there's nothing in the development of their essence, in their real awareness of their being existence. You know, there's nothing.
Yeah.
They're vacuous inside. They're empty.
Yeah.
Terrestrial nullities, you know.
Yeah.
He portrayed even like the stars and all these Hasnamas individuals, he calls them, who might are all puffed up like hot air pies, With a hot air pie, if you prick the surface, the whole thing deflates. It's like all false ego. It's all, there's really nothing inside. You know, like, who are these people who, you know, want to kind of scheme all these horrible things against human beings and poison them and spray them and, you know, irradiate their food and starve them and give them illnesses and give them poisons to treat their illnesses. Who are these people? Like, they're so driven by money, sex, and power, wanting control over people. It's like the ultimate control freaks, you know? Yeah. It's really quite shocking, you know?
Yeah. When you were in New Zealand and I did the show a month ago by myself, I talked about, when I was talking about, you know, Gurdjieff and Uspensky first meeting in Russia and the development of their relationship and how Gurdjieff was telling these students, you know, about the beginnings of his teaching, was presenting it and talking about how in our normal waking state we're not conscious and that we don't possess an eye in the sense of a permanent center and that we don't possess freedom or will. And Gurdjieff explained that the fourth way was a teaching which differed from the three traditional paths of the way of the fakir, the monk, and the yogi, which is the development of the body to attain will and the mastering of one's emotions to realize spiritual truths, and in the yogi's case, the development of intellect. And Gurdjieff said that the fourth way was different in the sense that it worked simultaneously on the intellectual, emotional, and physical centers to try to bring them into harmony and into balance, and that by doing so that you could accelerate the processes of conscious evolution. And at one of the meetings that they had subsequent to that, Uspensky said, you know, for a man of Western culture, it would be hard to accept that a fakir or a monk or a yogi who had retired from life was pursuing a course of evolution while an educated European was, quote, moving in a circle from which there was no escape. And Gurdjieff said, yes, but that's because people believe in progress and culture. And he said, there is no progress whatsoever. And he said, civilized and cultured people live with exactly the same interests as the most ignorant savages. Modern civilization is based on violence and slavery and fine words. But all these fine words about progress and civilization, excuse me, are merely words. And so Uspensky goes on and he talks about how at the time this produced a very deep impression on his group because it was 1916. And he said, you know, the latest manifestation of civilization was the First World War, you know, the war to end all wars. And he said, you know, it was drawing millions and millions of people into its orbit. And then Uspensky recites that story about the lorry loads of crutches that he saw. He saw a truck go by in a downtown street, and it was filled with these, filled to the top, with these crutches, unpainted crutches. And he said I was particularly struck by these lorries in these mountains of crutches for legs which were not yet torn off. There was a particularly cynical mockery of all the things with which people deceive themselves. Involuntarily, I imagined that similar lorries were sure to be going about in Berlin, Paris, London, Vienna, Rome, and Constantinople. And as a result, all these cities, almost all of which I knew so well and liked just because they were so different and because they supplemented and gave contrast to one another, had now become hostile both to me and to each other and separated by new walls of hatred and crime. I spoke to our people about these lorry loads of crutches and of my thoughts about them at the meeting. Gurdjieff said, what do you expect? People are machines. Machines have to be blind and unconscious. They cannot be otherwise. And all their actions have to correspond to their nature. Everything happens. No one does anything. Progress and civilization, the real meaning of these words, can appear only as a result of conscious efforts. They cannot appear as a result of unconscious mechanical actions. And what conscious efforts can there be in machines? And if one machine is unconscious, then 100 machines are unconscious, and so are 1,000 machines, or 100,000, or 1,000,000. And the unconscious activity of 1,000,000 machines must necessarily result in destruction and extermination. It is precisely in unconscious, involuntary manifestation that all evil lies. You do not understand and cannot imagine all the results of this evil. but the time will come when you will understand. And so, like, when I presented that, like I said, you know, just imagine this is at the beginning of the First World War, the war to end all war, which killed millions of people. But this is in the century, the most progressive century, supposedly, in the history of humankind, when the development of knowledge was greatest. It's the 20th century. I think most people would agree to that. So during the 20th century, this is Gurdjieff's statement about modern civilization is based on lies and fine words and slavery. He says, this is before the genocide in Armenia, which is still a great source of controversy in Turkey today. They still deny that it happened, but it did. Before the Russian Revolution, before Stalin's purges and the Ukrainian famine, before the Japanese atrocities in China and the rape of Nanking, before the Second World War, which would kill 50 million people, before the Holocaust, before Hiroshima, before Nagasaki, before the Chinese Revolution, before the H-bomb, before the Korean War, before Vietnam, before Biafra, before Pol Pot and the Cambodian genocide, before the death squads in Central America, before the regimes in Chile and Argentina, before the massacres in East Timor, before South Africa, before Ethiopia and Eritrea, before the Soviets in Afghanistan, before Star Wars, before Bosnia, before the Gulf War, before the Congo. In other words, all of this was said before the unfolding of what is generally heralded as the greatest century of human progress. So what is it about progress and knowledge which we're missing? I mean, there's something essentially missing in all this, and I would say it's that there's no development of consciousness and being that which parallels the development of knowledge.
Yeah, well, that's shocking. Yeah.
Well, it's just
said no,
you know,
to think of all those horrible crimes done through, and it's just ongoing. I mean, and now we're in just as crazy a time, you know, around the whole world because of these same forces and the same things, you know. And you turn on the TV and that's culture, you know. you get this total false kind of consciousness created by the media of what's going on, and titillation of all the games, you know, games and distractions, like, you know, with gaming and sports for Gurdjieff, you know, and fashion and things like that. He saw it's kind of titillations that wasted people's energies and created this kind of false culture. And
yeah, well, I mean, there's so many aspects to it. I mean, and that's,
well, there is. Yeah, there's so many aspects to it.
I mean, the whole consumer society is basically meant to, as long as, you know, it's like that great John Lennon, you know, song of the working class hero, you know, keep you doped with religion and sex and TV, and you think you're so clever and classless and free, but you're still effing peasants as far as I can see, you know.
Wow.
I mean, that's
you know, neat lines.
Yeah, it's just pretty powerful, and it's pretty true. I mean, as you say, it titillates and it distracts people, and it creates wants and desires in them which aren't real. It's like, it's interesting what you were saying. I'm going to backtrack a little bit about what you were saying about in Beelzebub, about how he says that the emotional center had been in the region of the breast and then displaced, because there's something that over the years in reading Uspensky's version of things, and I think I read this in terms of Gurdjieff saying, he makes a distinction between feelings and emotions, and I realize that. I think that what he's saying is that real emotions exist in the heart, but feelings are more related to the, you know, our likes and our dislikes, the appetitive dimensions that govern the emotional center in its lowest form and its most mechanical form, whereas, like, real emotions involve feelings of, you know, of compassion and remorse of conscience, and you know, like, they're qualitatively different, and they're not egoistically centered, whereas our feelings are egoistically centered and related to our wants and desires. Would you say?
Wow, that's really nicely expressed, how you express that. I mean, that's excellent distinction.
Yeah, because I've often wondered
to differentiate those terms.
Yeah, I've often wondered about that, because, you know, I never really got that about when he said there's a difference between feelings and emotions, you know, and I never really kind of understood it until just now when you were talking about that. And I think that's what he's suggesting, you know, and it's really
exactly.
It's kind of it goes along too, like with the heart master Adi Da, when he talks about, you know, how people can't be in their hearts, you know, because their hearts are knotted and they're constricted and they're so caught up in their ego identifications, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so what to pick up on then here? Where are we? Today we had. So let's try to just recap what we've been talking about. So kind of, I think the distinction between essence and personality. I remember I was very taken by that distinction early on when I was a graduate student in psychology, and Gurdjieff talking about the development of essence and personality. And essence is what you are in your being, in the structures of your being, your different faculties and how those might be developed. So that's kind of what you are in your essential nature. And if you're in your essential nature, he explains that you can, quote, instinctually sense reality, that you can instinctually know things and feel things mentally and emotionally. But we don't develop these faculties. Instead, we become conditioned into the false ego, the personality, the acquired nature. And the personality, he says, is what's acquired from without. So it's conditioning influences, and it's taking into yourself something that originates from without yourself. So a personality is acquired from your conditioning and the influence of things around you. So people accumulate that more and don't develop in their own essence. So, and how these, we need to develop both sides of our being and knowledge, and the personality and the mind and the brain allows us to attain knowledge and then higher knowledge. That's part of our faculties.
Yeah, it's essentially the, you know, parallels what I was talking about with the idea of knowledge and being when he says that,
yeah,
know, that there's two lines. There's the development of the line of knowledge and the development of the line of being. He says, you know, people in Western culture just value the development of the line of knowledge. And he said, you know, somebody can be an accomplished scientist, and he says he still has the right to be a petty, egoistic, caviling, mean, envious, vain, naive, and absent-minded man. It seems to be considered here that a professor must always forget his umbrella everywhere. And as he says, you know, that really what people don't recognize, and this I think is the central critique I would have of modern science, is that they don't realize that the level of one's knowledge is determined by the level of one's being, that there are certain limits on what you can know if you exist in a lower level of being. So if you're in a state of waking sleep and you don't have, and you haven't developed the higher states of consciousness and being, then you can't know objective realities that exist and then inform the physical plane of existence and really underlie them. And that's why, in a sense, really science has to come to mysticism and esotericism in order to really develop a comprehensive knowledge and understanding of ourselves and our place in the universe. We have to develop these higher faculties of consciousness and being.
Yeah. Yeah, know thyself and thou wilt know the universe and the gods.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I was reading that part in Uspensky in The Search of the Miraculous. It's really nice what Gurdjieff says, that when he's talking about the line of knowledge and the line of being, he said that the problem with the, you know, what we take as knowledge is that it will always be a knowledge of one thing together with the ignorance of another thing, a knowledge of the detail without a knowledge of the whole, a knowledge of the form without a knowledge of the essence, which really, I mean, that's the problem in a sense in most modern knowledge in conventional thinking about things, is that it's always very circumscribed, and it's the knowledge of the one thing with the ignorance of another. It's the knowledge of the part without the knowledge of the whole. It's the knowledge of the form without the knowledge of the essence. Whereas by contrast, I mean, and that's what I would say is, to me, makes the fourth way so fascinating, is that it's all of those things. It's the coherence of the entire system, is that everything informs everything else in the system. And as it progresses, it deepens and it becomes more precise, but at the same time it becomes more comprehensive, which is really quite at odds with, I'd say, any other kind of philosophy that I know of, in the sense that I don't think most of them, when you study them, allow more comprehensive knowledge and understanding of things, and at the same time a more precise knowledge and understanding of things. I was trying to write about this the other night, and I was trying to, you know, describe, like, it's very difficult kind of to convey it without a sense of, you know, the development of it in terms of your own life. But after 30 years of, I'd say, like, for me, that's what I see in the fourth way, which is so fascinating, is that it always deepens. Like, I'm just reading In Search of the Miraculous for probably the fifth or sixth time I've read it. And every time I read it, it's just, you know, it becomes more and more profound, because I have more knowledge to relate it to, but I think I have more being to relate it to, too. Like, I think there's something's changed in me that I can feel it and sense it in different ways, too.
Yeah. Yeah, it's such a remarkable kind of teaching about the relationship of a human being in ourself, how we're related to the larger cosmos. Like,
yeah.
It strikes me, for Gurdjieff, your essence is related to the levels of the ray of creation, to what he calls, to what the sun and to the planets. So in the ray of creation, the essence derives from the sun and the planets, whereas your personality is related to the level of the earth, and your false personality is related to the level of the moon. So we have these different levels. All of us have these different levels, from the sun level to the moon level. We all have those levels within ourselves. So we have the sun, what constitutes the sun within ourselves, the planets, the earth, and the moon. And these levels are related to different, the earth is related to the physical body, and the astral body is related to the planetary sphere, and the mental body is related to the sun. And the divine, the fourth room, is an even beyond that. That's related to the level of the starry world. And that's kind of, the starry world, that's the divine level, that's the fourth room. So, Gurdjieff provides kind of a remarkable teaching how we could exist on the earth, but then upon death, you might gravitate to the moon, or you might linger around on the earth, or you might pass into the planetary sphere, or you might return down into the sun. That there's an inner progression and continuity to the existence of the inner self-being awareness in the human being. And we pass into different realms according to our constitution and makeup. So it's a remarkable kind of model, a systematic kind of teaching about, you know, what evolution, spiritual evolution, it can entail, which is the development of the astral and mental bodies, and then attaining to the fourth level, which is that of the divine element in the starry world. So these are levels within ourselves, and that's related to the actual physical earth and sun and planets and moon and so on. So that the soul after death can be drawn to the moon. Like Gurdjieff talks sometimes, and Adi Da talks similarly, of the moon living off the souls of man, and how sometimes the moon needs more, is hungry, and so then humankind is ruled by lunacy, and everybody goes out and they mass murder each other to feed the moon, you know? that kind of lunacy of humankind, like in war and the warfare, and and oh. how that becomes necessary, because he talks about how the mentation or the level of being existence of human beings falls so low that they don't properly feed the moon. So because their being existence is so low, they don't develop their inner being. The moon requires the deaths of more people in order to be fed, because people haven't developed in their soul life. So when they die, they're not, you know, it doesn't provide very little to the moon. So the moon kind of requires more souls of humankind, and it lives carnivorously on the souls of humankind. Adida even saw on the moon a place where people were kind of enslaved in underground places, and these kind of like transdimensional beings that inhabit the moon and feed off the souls of humankind. That's part of, like, Gurdjieff puts even a phenomena like war. He relates to the issues of the life of the moon and the planets.
And
so it's related also to this kind of epic cosmic ray of creation, you know?
Yeah, it's really interesting listening just to you talk about this, because a lot of what you're saying, I think, is more kind of from the, I mean, it's in Gurdjieff's earlier talks, but it's more in Beelzebub's Tales where he emphasizes this. And I was thinking, like, you know, in Search of the Miraculous, it's a reproduction of by Uspensky, a brilliant piece of reporting, because he didn't write it until several years afterwards, and he didn't publish the book until after his death and Uspensky's death in 1947. And Gurdjieff said when he heard the excerpts, you know, he said, "Very good memory, his soul," you know. But it's a reproduction of these brilliant lectures that Gurdjieff gave, and he's very lucid. He's very straightforward. He's very, you know, Uspensky said he was the greatest lecturer he'd ever heard. And then in Beelzebub's Tales, this book is written in this allegorical form where nothing is directly told per se, and it's a tale. And it's the language of it, Gurdjieff's style is, especially at the beginning when you're reading it, it's almost impenetrable, because it's very difficult and it's very mannered, and it upsets the rhythm of it's peculiar, and it upsets all your sort of expectations about good writing. But if you persist and you read it with some attention and with some effort, you begin to gain this feeling about things, which is really interesting. I mean, first of all, it's told from the perspective of an alien intelligence, from the perspective of a higher intelligence who's looking down on these things on Earth, these three brain beings of the planet Earth, or as Hasin Beelzebub's grandson refers to them, the slugs. And so you have this cosmic perspective on humanity, which engenders this sense in the reader of distancing himself from these very peculiar three-brain beings that occupy the planet Earth. And so it provides this very interesting kind of emotional distance and separation from everything that we take to be the truth about who we are and what we are. And really, when the more you work at trying to understand what he's saying, the more you get this very strange feeling that very peculiar emotional states arise from this. That's my experience of it. And I think it's an oversimplification, but in broad terms, I would say that In Search of the Miraculous is aimed at depicting consciousness and explaining how consciousness can be developed, whereas Beelzebub's Tales is more an appeal to conscience and to higher emotions in us, and is an attempt to awaken these things and to stimulate these impulses in us, which are very much dormant, and which need shocks to wake us up to these to the reality of these things within us. But I think that he does that in that book, and the more you read it, the more it comes out. And then part of it is just that everything is portrayed in this very alien language, you know, where in very unconventional terms, and some of it's absurd on first reading or second reading or third reading, but the more you work at it, the more you realize that there's something very profound kind of in all of the of what he says in this book.
Yeah. I want to just take a moment here, and why don't we open it up from now until the end of the show to telephone numbers, and meant to hand those out. Okay,
yeah.
So in the U.S., I guess one is 877-876-5227. And toll-free in U.S. or Canada is 888-815-9756. And I guess a third direct line, 530-876-3222. So those are the numbers. If anyone wants to kind of come in and comment on anything we've been talking about, or I open the lines up. Okay, Jim. Just coming back to the aspects of Beelzebub's tales. It's funny. Of all my books, the one I would most like to expand now is my book called The Slugs, based on Beelzebub's tales. I've done a newer revision of it, which I'm really pleased with, and have copies here with color pictures inside, which is rare because usually my books are only black and white photocopy inside. But anyway, what was I going to say about the slugs? What we're just talking about. I most would want to expand on that book, because now I'm grasping the significance of all of these new aspects of Beelzebub's tales, and which is commentary he provides on, like, the culture and history of humankind. Firstly, like, the idea of him actually being a being that come an alien that comes from another solar system elsewhere and comes to our solar system and sets up an observatory on Mars. And now there's evidences that there have been features on Mars, and there have been beings on Mars. And some people maintain now that human beings have bases on Mars. Okay, so that's not totally unfeasible, and in the Beelzebub's tales, Gurji says there are other beings on other planets, and he says there are beings on the moon, which he says tunnel it out. And I mean, some of these things aren't, some people think that there's substance to some of these things, of there being beings on the moon and lunatics and UFOs from the dark side of the moon, or, you know, things on the moon. So, I mean, Beelzebub's Tales, which is written back in the 1950s, is kind of this story. Really, it's about, you know, aliens coming from another solar system and being on the other planets and inhabiting them and continuing to, and being on the moon and, you know, observing and interacting with beings on Earth. And they interbreed, these beings from Beelzebub's tribe kind of interbreed with human beings in Beelzebub's tales, in the story, and become mixed with them through the ages. So all that aspect of what things he says about, you know, kind of that's about, I mean, even in this book, he's on a spacecraft, he's on a spaceship, and he's kind of, that can travel within the galaxy. So this kind of like this futuristic spaceship, and he's traveling, and he visits, the spaceship's called Occasion. Oh no, that's what he used to use when he visited the planet Earth from the planet Mars. And he says in Beelzebub's Tales, he visited it on six occasions. And he lived among human beings on the planet at six periods during human history. And the first one was beginning with Atlantis, because Beelzebub has a lifespan much longer than our own. So he could,
you know, witness and visit Earth at these different periods, beginning with Atlantis, and then the sixth visit in his book is in kind of 1920s, 30s Europe and the United States. So in contemporary period, so over thousands of years.
I was just going to say, that's actually when he wrote the book. He didn't write it in the 50s. He wrote it in the 20s and 30s. Like,
yeah.
The book was published in the 50s, but
yeah, but he was, his sixth visit was to his contemporary, like, his society at that point.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Like, he actually didn't write the book in the 50s. He wrote it in the 20s. But, yeah, I, it's funny because you were saying I thought you were going to say that when you were talking about his observation, of observations of humans, is like, the book is really quite hilarious when he's recounting the history of humankind, and he talks about the Romans and the Greeks, and he has all these kind of derogatory phrases about the accomplishments of people. I think Romans ended up perfecting ways of making pasta or something like that. It's some of the total of their civilization or something. But it's interesting because he talks about the different visits of messengers from above to humankind to try to awaken them, and you know, these spiritual messengers, and how the various effects that they've had, like in the very saintly labors of Ashiata Shamash, and how his labors led to a certain level of awakening, and then people fell asleep again. It's very interesting when he's talking about in those terms, just the idea of how, you know, different people have tried to different higher beings have tried to intervene at different periods of human history.
Yeah, that's amazing in the tales. Yeah, he calls them sacred messengers actualized from above.
Yeah.
Is a phrase he uses at times, actualized from above. And
Shamash.
Yeah, he particularly, it's interesting. Gurdjieff says there are three basic higher emotions, which are faith, hope, and love. And the Ashiash Shimash, when he visited the earth as a sacred messenger, he found that the traditional ways of religion, with the emphasis on faith, hope, and love, that people had, their psyche had degenerated so far that they couldn't appeal to them on the basis of faith, hope, and love. But that the connection to people was this awakening of conscience within human beings. And that was the way of Ashiash Shimash, was the awakening of conscience, because their conscience had passed into their subconscious.
Yeah.
And Gurdjieff regarded the awakening of conscience as so essential to the inner alchemy of a human being. He describes it at one point as the fire that burns away the residues. So it's just like the melting pot or the fire, the awakening of conscience and remorse of conscience. And that's kind of an aspect of awakening to higher emotional center, I guess, like a transitional thing to experiencing higher love and emotions and faith, hope, and love on the higher level. So Gurdjieff regards like the remorse of conscience as like a portal, in a way, like the means to by which to attain to a higher level of ourselves.
Well, you know, one of the things that, as a result of the very saintly labors, that's, when you're talking about faith, hope, and love, the very saintly labors of Ashiata Shamash, is that at the end, Gurdjieff says that now, in order to save the three brain beings of the planet Earth, it would be necessary to implant an organ in them, in the sense that something which would, he says, an organ this time of such properties that every one of these unfortunates during the process of existence should constantly sense and be cognizant of the inevitability of his own death, as well as the death of everyone upon whom his eyes or attention rests. which is really interesting in terms of what we're talking about in terms of knowledge and being earlier. I think this is one of the most important ideas in Gurdjieff that he talks about, is that if we could remember the inevitability of our own death and of everyone around us, it would change us. It changes significantly. In a way, I think he's referring to it in terms of his system as the second conscious shock, right? There's self-remembering, and then there's this, as if we were emotionally centered so that we could actually remember the inevitability of our own death and that of everyone around us, it would change us profoundly emotionally, and we would develop higher being and consciousness. And in a way, like, this is very interesting, this idea, because one of the things is that everybody knows that they're going to die, but nobody can remember it. And that's one of the most fascinating differences between this idea of the developing knowledge and developing being. Like, I would suggest an experiment that anybody can do is to try to remember the inevitability of their own death and of that of everyone with whom they have contact for 24 hours. And I don't mean like just try to remember it. Try to remember that fact. Don't dwell on it in a morbid sense. We're all going to die, or, you know, don't be frightened of it. Don't have any emotional reaction to it. Just try to remember it. And what you'll observe, the first thing you'll realize if you do that for 24 hours is that you can't remember the idea. You'll forget it. You'll become absorbed and embedded in your own processes of thinking and feeling and moving physically and your actions and everything will distract you and you won't be able to remember it. But every once in a while you'll wake up and you'll remember, oh yeah, I was trying to remember the inevitability of my death. And what you'll find eventually, as they say, is that you can't do it. That's the first thing. So you can know that. Everybody knows that, but nobody can remember it. And this is enormously important. And if you try to continue to do that over a period of time, it's interesting, like, I try to do that, and I forget all the time, but when I do it, and I'm successful in doing it, it engenders something really, it brings something out emotionally in you, which is really, really fascinating, and which I think is, like, gives a hint as to how your consciousness could be fundamentally altered if you could actually remember this. There's a reference to that, like, I think Krishna, in the Bhagavad Gita, says something basically that tells Arjuna that, you know, the most remarkable thing about human beings is that they can look around and see everybody around them and not realize that they're going to die, you know, and it's basically the same idea, but it's in the Bhagavad Gita too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that we're going to die, and yet, but then Krishna says to Arjuna, he says, the wise lament neither the living nor the dead.
Right.
And so the wise don't lament death because they know, he says, that death, the eternal element, is still there in every living being. The jiva atma, the eternal element, the kind of spiritual spark. So, and that there's continued existence in other forms into the subtle dimensions and will reincarnate again. So it's continued kind of self-existence. So that's why we don't lament then for death, because we realize that the essential being is still present and still continuing in their soul's adventures through this larger kind of cosmic system, and with continued existence in other subtle planes. It's interesting how, like, to imagine, like, where are these other subtle planes, and to actually identify them with different levels and aspects of the actual physical world. Like, the idea of going to the moon. Okay, you could go to the moon, or you could haunt the earth, or you might pass to a planet or live in a planetary level, or you might pass to the sun. But there are actually these different levels of continued being existence that are possible to us. And it's interesting how Gurdjieff talks about attaining, you know, if we attain the fourth room, then we acquire the causal body. And then we become immortal within the limits of the solar system.
So he's actually saying we can attain a certain level of immortality and continued self-existence over these huge periods of time and attain this kind of immortality. And then you see in modern science and in the news and such is these kind of new claims that like how human beings want to attain immortality in their physical body. And they want to try to do this through all kind of genetic things and kind of experimentation to acquire like physical immortality. You know, it's such a false idea, kind of like a way to attain immortality is in the development of your higher being bodies. You know, because otherwise, like your bodies, you know, it's just natural. You know, observe nature. Things grow up, they grow older, they die. You know, it happens all in nature, and you're not going to be an exception. So don't put your faith in immortality in the physical body. It's a false idea. You know, put up your store in heaven, you know, in terms of developing your higher being bodies for the continued existence of your soul through afterlife states. And it's important what we attain through our life is what we carry through death, because it's emphasized so much how our own psychological makeup kind of carries us into afterlife realms corresponding to our own makeup. Like I read that stories about the astral worlds and, you know, how someone's aunt will be kind of living in her favorite cottage with her favorite flowers and she kind of exists in this astral realm somewhere. And it's a more pleasurable world, kind of a paradise world of her own creation in a way. You know, so some people might exist within realms like that, and other people are taken into subterranean worlds and kind of imprisoned by them within the moon or in lower levels of the earth and so on, you know. That the soul can pass into different realms and, you know, other people might ascend to the sun. Like the Dalai Lama explains in Tibetan Buddhism, the aim upon death is to attain to the greater body of radiance. And to pass into this greater body of radiance. So it's like blending again with the sun, but the sun on a deeper level is body of radiance. And if you don't attain that, then attain, secondly, the second body of radiance. So you try to attain to these more spiritualized worlds upon death and through the passage through death, attain to these higher spiritual levels. And then he explains if a person doesn't pass into attain either of those realms, then they're drawn into the bardos, which are the kind of these different levels of afterlife existence. So the lowest bardos are like hell worlds, but there are these different bardo realms that people can be drawn into. I remember one fellow when I was at York University, a fellow who claimed to be astral traveling extensively and describing how there are realms where people who are used to kind of getting in a car and driving to work every day, well, they go there and they have jobs there in the astral world and they're doing the same things. They're doing the same things. And the golfers are still golfing and getting more holes
kind of
fun. You know, that there is continued that you live on in these realms. You kind of create your own realms in your thoughts and feelings in some subtle way.
Yeah, I'm stuck in an afterlife traffic.
Sorry?
I'm stuck in an afterlife traffic jam.
Yeah.
It's so funny when you say that. Like they go to work and they play golf, yeah. But yeah, because I mean that idea. I mean, in a certain sense, too, it makes sense. Like you know, in terms of like, if the meaning of your life is in these terms, and there is some form of afterlife, well, you would go to some sort of, you know, dimension where the same level of meaning existed, you know? I mean, it's not,
yeah.
In a way, it's kind of funny. It's kind of, it's almost logical, you know what I mean? It's like the thing if, you know, that death isn't the end, but it's just stepping into another room, but the other room's pretty much like the room that you were in before, you know? I mean, it's an interesting concept, you know? I had a friend years ago, remember Gail at, Gail Kuahara that was in our groups at York said to me one time we were talking about this idea and she said, "You're going to end up in a bar, buddy."
In a what?
A bar. Because we were always going to bars together. That would be my afterlife.
Well, I mean, I think that happens, and you certainly,
yeah.
In older cities, you'd have many ghosts still haunting the bars and streets of, you know, London and Paris and other world centers, you know. And your local bars,
that
people do haunt bars, and you know, sometimes you can go in places and you feel that you can feel the energies around you of such things, and yeah, there's certain quality of feeling to things that are haunted.
Yeah.
And
well, even that expression is interesting. When somebody says that they visited their local haunts, you know, like they're the places that they haunt, you know, it's like,
wow,
it's
that's interesting,
like,
isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of like it's because that's where their part of them is, you know, and so when they pass on, part of them will sort of be left there on this plane too. I mean, one of the things too that you're talking about earlier is like one thing that's kind of important to remember in terms of Gurdjieff's system is that this idea of the ray of creation, and you're talking about the level of the sun and the level of the planets and the level of the solar system, is that these are dimensions of differing levels of consciousness and materiality, and that the higher dimensions interpenetrate the lower dimensions. So in a sense, in the external cosmos they exist, but on some level, like Gurdjieff says, you don't need to go to the sun to investigate the matter that's in the sun. It's in us because these levels interpenetrate us. And so it's like these levels exist within us in a very real sense because they're these higher levels, because they're lower because they're more refined, higher frequency levels of vibration and of materiality which actually interpenetrate us. And so it's like, you know, we don't have to go anywhere in a sense, like, because they're in us on a real level. I mean, that's the amazing aspect of this model is that within us, we can pass into these higher dimensions by developing the subtle anatomy and the higher being bodies, which are part of us but are undeveloped, but we can actually be in these other worlds and these other dimensions and in the most profound states of samadhi and nirvana and higher states of cosmic consciousness, people actually are unified with the universal structure and interpenetrate every point of existence, which is in time and space, which is really difficult
to
even imagine,
but
it's a model that's consistent, eh?
Yeah, of the microcosm being connected to the macrocosm.
Yeah.
And somehow being, I mean, it goes back to know thyself and thou will know the universe and the God. So to know the universe means that somehow the whole universe, see, that's what's so unusual about mystical teachings. In a way, mystical teachings say everything is ultimately a one undivided whole.
Mm.
And there's no entity in anything that's not part of that whole underlying whole. So everything is kind of interconnected from the very beginning of all time. So everything is interconnected inwardly, even in terms of the physics. It evolves out of the quantum field theory. You apply it.
Yeah.
The universe emerged from a singularity condition. So everything that differentiates from a singularity condition remains interrelated in higher dimensional phase space, information fields that permeate the physical reality. So we're all tied in as we evolve through these information fields in higher dimensional space. So we all are parts of one, differentiated from parts of one, through this inner physics, which kind of applies to each of us in the inner world. So,
And in a sense, what's so interesting about it is that, everything differentiates and becomes increasingly complex in a certain way, but, it's an illusion in the sense that on some level, there's no differentiation. I like that's what's so fascinating about it. It's like there is and there isn't, you know, because we really everything is a manifestation from this original singularity, and somehow if we were really aware, like in terms of human beings, if we were really aware of ourselves and knew ourselves, we'd realize that we were one with this original singularity or whatever it is, like this point source.
Yeah, that the expansion of our consciousness might occur in a holographic way somehow.
Yeah,
yeah, through the dynamics and holography, through multi-dimensions. It all ties together. What I like about mystical teachings is it does provide you with a coherent model of afterlife states and processes. Like it's a consistent framework of ideas. Doesn't mean it's true. It doesn't mean it's false. But in a way, it's supported by all kinds of evidences for, you know, reincarnation, afterlife states, you know, choosing your next life, like moving, you know, living in afterlife dimensions, having ghosts, having hauntings, all the psychical phenomena that have been testimony through centuries of human existence, all these evidences which the mainstream has kind of denied, those things were always true all the way along. You had all these evidences right before your eyes, kind of, you know. So all of these things have been true, and yes, sir.
Oh, I was just going to say,
and then mystical spiritual teachings actually give you like ways of conceptualizing how these phenomena might be possible. That how we can have different bodies, like physical, astral, mental bodies, and that there's even a fourth level, which is like pure eye, and that's kind of So it's, you know, it's a model of human metaphysics, or the metaphysics of consciousness, you know? Okay. Do we have a guest?
Hello?
Hello.
Hi. Hi, I'm Scott. I'm calling from St. Louis.
Oh, yeah. Hi, Scott. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Chris. Hey, I really like a lot of your work. I heard you on Coast to Coast about esoteric teachings and things of that nature. I'm very interested in it. And I just want to make a comment. Yesterday I went to the Passion service at a Catholic church, and one of the things I noticed in the readings that you might like your comments on is that at the very end of the Passion of John, it talked about how Jesus, they gave the crowd a choice of either letting Jesus free or Barabbas, who was a kind of a revolutionary who I'm sure probably wanted to overthrow Rome. And though Jesus circulated it, and work with these people, they still wanted the revolutionary freed, the person that could probably throw over Rome, and they wanted to put to death, in my kind of understanding, a more of an esoteric spiritual leader like Jesus. And it seems like those people were just as kind of sleepwalking as we are, or we're probably even more asleep than they are at this point in time. What are your comments?
That's an interesting story, and I always thought that people who wanted Barabbas were paid off and bribed or something. I don't know. I mean, I think we are just as asleep, so the story, any other comments, Jim? Anything you'd like to say? I'll try to gather my thoughts more. This idea of Jesus and Barabbas. Yeah, they would rather. They chose to execute Jesus. It's a Good Friday today, so it's an appropriate and Easter today. So I guess Jesus only 3 days and rose again.
Yeah, but you know,
there's different roads again in the spiritual body.
Yeah, but I think the Bible also has a lot of examples of people that are like alone. You know, even though the whole world, you know, the whole world possibly can be wrong. And you know, Noah, you know, who built the ark, him and eight other people. I mean, everyone else was wiped out. I think there's examples to where everyone else can be wrong, and you know, maybe the handful of people that are attracted to the more of a esoteric or experiential type of a spiritual experience. I mean, there might only be maybe, who knows, maybe a dozen people in the whole world that are really open to the idea and really, really take it to heart. And not just, it's not just something that they dismiss.
I think we're all needing to be rescued from the flood. I think the Noah is really appropriate because I see the ominous signs of a flood ahead of us and what is coming down upon us, what the momentum is. It's like Uspensky in Russia, seeing all the craziness of humankind, all these preparations for war and this kind of mass insanity. And it's like those human beings, you know, have to feed the moon and carry out what Gurdjieff calls the processes of reciprocal self-destruction, you know. So I think we're going, all of a sudden people are going to get some shocks. There's so many shocks. People woke up to what's really happening in our society and world. The absolute insanity of it all is really quite horrifying.
Yeah. I've never heard anyone really explain the feeding of the moon before, those kind of aspects. Do you think that was part of the Mayan and the Aztec kind of philosophy or some mindset or something that took them over?
I really don't know, and that's a very interesting question. And unfortunately, I've just not had time to read in those areas as I'd like to be able to answer that. That's very interesting. I would like to look at what they saw as the moon and the sun and such.
And I'm just curious about, along the lines of the Mayans and that, I'm just curious, a lot of your teachings about raising your consciousness or your spiritual awareness somewhat seems along the lines of Maurice Cottrell in some of his teaching. He doesn't seem to be quite as into the heart, into the emotion as you are, which I really like, but he does talk about raising one's consciousness or spiritual kind of voltage or to where you could kind of break the plane and actually, you know, rise up into a higher plane of consciousness.
Yeah, well, I'm not familiar with his work, but that's the idea that we can make these breakthroughs in terms of attaining of consciousness and kind of experience in these other realms. Experiencing things astrally and mentally and through the mind body.
Okay. I enjoy your work and I'll be listening from now on. Thanks, Christopher.
Yeah, thanks for calling, Scott.
Okay.
Jim, hold on, Scott.
Okay.
Jim, did you have any comments you wanted to add? Or?
Well, I just want to one thought I had. It's a very interesting question and I hadn't, you know, really given it much thought, but just in terms of you know, crucifying Jesus and freeing the thief, you know, or the revolutionary, it's like the lower never understands the higher. And so in a way, I mean, that's partly what we were talking about before about these other messengers from above, is that they're never really understood. And because the lower the level of human beings acts from their sleep and from their mechanicalness, they always turn their backs or in this case, you know, kill the messenger in a sense, and but I mean, there's a whole other angle to that because in Gurdjieff's explanation of the crucifixion, he said it was all scripted and that it had to occur as it had. I mean,
yeah.
And that Jesus did have to die, and that Judas didn't betray Jesus, but really fulfilled his role because it was a drama that was carried out for certain purposes. I mean, you can interpret that on a variety of levels, but but like on the most basic levels, like I say, like the lower never understands the higher. So he speaks on a different level, so he's not understood, and so he's persecuted.
Yeah, it's like the kingdom in heaven or the kingdom on earth, kind of.
Yeah.
But
I think that whole story, too, though, I mean, just Jesus' actions in the whole trial, he didn't, like, defend himself. He kind of, in his defenselessness, he kind of willfully went, and most lower beings would, you know, come up with all kinds of excuses and out, you know, to get out of to save their life, but he, you know, he was willing to give it away in order to reach a higher realization, or to show a higher realization to us, to help us understand.
Yeah, wow. Yeah.
Well, I mean, when you're talking about lower beings that never get it, I think that one of the last things he said was, you know, forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do. And there's a lot of examples in the Bible where they say, you know, it's easy to kind of get along and like people that, you know, that kind of believe with you or talk or your friend, but you know, the real spiritual for us, Maurice Cratchell kind of talks about this, but the real spiritual kind of like energy or voltage that we could get is to forgive our enemies and or even to love our enemies or to see it through how you expressed it, through a lower kind of a consciousness where they really are kind of acting as robots or they're really not themselves in a way.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. They don't know what possessed them. You know, they didn't realize what they were doing. Nobody does. Everybody kind of gets caught up in this drama and they're bought out in different ways and they don't realize what they're doing. And they kind of sell off their souls in a way.
And your
through
comments,
politics, through money, through,
Your comments earlier about what sex, power, and, you know, the things that motivate people, it's so seductive to people.
Yeah.
And it's so, and everybody's in on it, so everybody thinks it's right, and this is the thing to do, you know, while you're here. And the kind of thoughts that you're talking about and sharing are, you know, it's not falling on deaf ears, but there's so many people that have kind of like easily have kind of like flipped over to the materialistic, you know, sex, power, drugs type lifestyle that's so seductive of the West. And you know.
Yeah, so absolutely, and which has been engendered and through the media and so much of the kind of activities of the corporate entities, you know.
Yes.
Terribly so. Terribly so. It's, I mean, it's just terrible what's been done to humanity, how humanity's kind of been poisoned and, you know, our food and air and environment and, you know,
yeah,
so much.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Dr. Holmes.
Yeah, thanks for calling in, Scott.
Okay. All right, bye.
Goodbye. Okay, we have 5-10 minutes left here, Jim. We had last week said we were going to talk today about human psychopathology and the causes of war, and I did come upon one passage I particularly wanted to pick up from the story of, and Beelzebub, I'm going to read a bit from the slugs, just quoting sections here. Beelzebub wanted to understand how these beings, how their essence is gradually brought to such a phenomenal being ableness to destroy, for no rhyme or reason, the existence of other beings similar to themselves. Okay, so how could a being get to be brought to the point of being able to destroy, for no rhyme or reason, the existence of another human being, okay? That's a part of in the tales here. And he concludes that this, quote, terrifying periodic being need to destroy each other's existence had been acquired over centuries due to the abnormal conditions of being, of the conditions of existence established there by past generations, as well as due to cowardice and fear. Quote, Beelzebub explains, he begins from a natural feeling of self-preservation to strive with all his being to destroy as many as possible of the existence of the beings of the enemy side in order to have the greater chance of saving his own existence. Okay? And it's like, wow, that's so cool how much that kind of applies to the world elites. It's kind of like, you know, how this plan, this genocidal plan that's discussed of how they want to reduce the world's population from 6 billion down to 500 million. And it's like, well, why would you want to have such a horrendous kind of fear? And it's like out of cowardice and fear in a way. Fear for their own being, self-existence, that saving their own existence. It's so, I mean, just think of that. I'll read it again. He begins from a natural feeling of self-preservation to strive with all his being to destroy as many as possible of the existence of beings of the enemy side in order to have the greater chance of surviving his own existence, of saving his own existence. So, yeah, it's pretty profound, eh?
Yeah.
And then I just wanted to reread these quotations. This is just from Beelzebub. What so Beelzebub talks about what he calls hasnamas individuals, which are these kinds of creatures that kind of, and he says they have seven, a spectrum of impulses. He calls them Neluosnian spectrum of impulses, and these include the following. The first, these include the tendencies, or seven impulses of these beings. First, towards every kind of depravity, conscious as well as unconscious. Okay, the second, the feeling of self-satisfaction from leading others astray. And it's like, wow, I just so see that, like, through the media, how the media has kind of completely led people astray in this whole kind of false culture and consciousness. The irresistible inclination to destroy the existence of other breathing creatures. You just see that, how just some people just have that kind of madness to destroy the existence of other breathing creatures. The urge to become free from the necessity of actualizing the being efforts demanded by nature. So he's saying that people don't make the efforts to work on themselves and make the actualizing the being efforts demanded by nature, how we have to work on ourselves to attain our soul. The attempt by every kind of artificiality to conceal from others what, in their opinion, are one's physical defects. I think that's so true. You know, this calm self-contentment in the use of what is not personally deserved, striving to be not what one is. I guess not to be seen for what one really is. And we don't want to become a terrestrial nullity or a lunatic.
Yeah.
And instead we have to try to strive in our being self-existence to attain to that level of wakefulness and awakening of the heart and illumination of the mind that we can attain through the paths of teaching like the Gurdjieff Fourth Way teaching, which we've been discussing today. And just to bring us back to the beginning of the show, the whole idea is about the psychology of man's possible evolution. And that's what the Gurdjieff Fourth Way teaching, that's the focus of it, is the idea of our inner evolution, of the inner being, and attaining to these higher levels of self and attaining, developing the astral and mental bodies, refining these higher being bodies for the life of the soul. And it's a very, very profound teaching with so many, and the book has so many different dimensions to it. Everything from, you know, giving us a perspective on aliens to the awakening of conscience to, you know, the hasnamas individuals and the history of the lunacy on planet Earth and so many things in the rich Gurdjieff teaching. Jim, do you have any comments or concluding remarks?
Well, I'll just read you very quickly something. This is a quote about war. We must get rid of the false notion that the creative spirit, which underlies all cultures and civilizations, needs to be defended by force. Spirit is never defended by recourse to violence. People try to defend only that which is already dead. We throw up our hands in horror when we read of the sacrificial rites of the Aztecs, but we see nothing ignoble in the periodic sacrifice of millions of lives in the names of country, God, democracy, or civilization. What monstrous things can these be in whose names these horrible sacrifices are demanded? Who is it that makes these demands? No one has the courage to assume the responsibility. Each one points the finger accusingly at the other. This attitude is in itself the most flagrant ambition of the evil of war. We exonerate ourselves by saying that we are merely defending ourselves. With this half-truth on our lips, we make ready to commit the most dastardly crimes. First we absolve ourselves of guilt, then we go about it with a vengeance. So long as the onus is conveniently shifted to the enemy, it matters not how we behave. That's from Henry Miller from Remember to Remember.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so horrifying seeing what's occurring.
Written in the Second World War, by the way.
Internationally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The more things change, the more they stay the same. You know, the weapons
yeah.
get better.
Yeah, the worse are weapons now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I was reading a thing on depleted uranium in Iraq saying that there was more depleted uranium there than 300,000 times the bombs of Nagasaki and Hiroshima. That there's that much kind of radioactive, you know, how it, and it was detected all around the world, you know.
Yeah.
It's just terrible kind of things. The processes of reciprocal self-destruction is what Beelzebub refers to them as. So, yeah, kind of periodic processes of reciprocal self-destruction.
Isn't it also periodic destruction of beings similar to themselves? Is that another one of the... Because he has different phrases for it, eh? But
yeah.
Anyway,
yeah,
I guess
so, yeah.
Next time, let's come back to this and talk a little bit more about it next time, too, because it's, you know, there's so many angles on this. We just sort of touched on it.
Yeah, 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 good. Okay, I'll advertise both my books. I have two books, The Slugs on Beelzebub's Tales and The Psychological Illusions, which is a presentation on the Gurdjieff Uspensky Fourth Wave Psychology. If any listeners are, you can see my website at zeropoint.ca. I'd like to thank listeners for listening.
Joining us.
Thanks, listeners. BBS Radio. Thanks, Scott, for calling in. We should open up the lines more often, Jim. It's always people, someone calls in, they always have a unique angle on something, you know.
Yeah,
it's great.
Really good to hear from people. Thanks, BBS. Thanks, Doug and Don. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, goodbye. In 2 weeks' time, this is Christopher Holmes. We'll be back for another session of Zero Point Radio. Thank you. Goodbye.